And our sermon text today is Job 28. Back in June, you may remember the soccer team of 12 boys and the coach who became trapped in a cave in Thailand. After entering and exploring that cave for a few moments of enjoyment after a match, well, heavy rains flooded the entrance while they were in there so that they could not get out. And pleasure soon turned to panic. Only after a mother of one of the boys reported him missing did anyone even begin looking for them, and where. Only after realizing where they had gone did Thai Navy SEALs begin a search of the maze of caves that they entered. And it began an 18-day odyssey to rescue them. Over 100 people participated in the rescue, and one Navy SEAL died trying to string oxygen tanks along the treacherous route out of the caves. Even after finding them, which was considered a miracle in itself, given the complexity, the depth of the routes the kids could have taken, rescuers calculated it could take months to get them out safely. But when the air inside the chamber where they were trapped began to grow toxic, and monsoon rains threatened to flood the chamber further, rescuers knew they needed to act. And they ended up navigating the boys out of the chamber, underwater, with oxygen, when some of the boys didn't even know how to swim. Can you imagine? I'm an experienced swimmer, qualified as a lifeguard in college, yet I get claustrophobia swimming under lane ropes in the public pool, much less in a dark cave for hundreds of yards. Each boy wore a full-face scuba mask, plus a wetsuit, boots, and helmet. Two Navy divers accompanied each boy, with the lead diver carrying the boy's air tank. The two divers guided the boy through the cave using a fixed rope. Each boy was tethered to the lead Navy diver. Patiently, the Thai Navy SEALs guided each boy, one by one, out of the depths of the dark, watery earth. The rescue is considered a modern testament to mankind's technological advancement, collective cooperation, and wisdom. Job, in the text before us today, says that this is child's play compared to finding God's wisdom so necessary to true life, yea, even eternal life. He even employs the analogy of plumbing the depths of the bowels of the earth to find wisdom. And he puts it so vividly before us today. Job has found true wisdom, however. And let's see how he does it, shall we? In the text before us, chapter 28. Chapter 28 of Job. One singular chapter that is just a gem. 4 points I want to make with you from this chapter today. First of all, wisdom refined, point one, wisdom refined. We have seen Job's wisdom all through this book. But here, after his suffering, we find wisdom refined in his life. Point number one, as Job experienced in his suffering, wisdom is not easily accessible, but hard fought and hard won. Verses 1 through 6. Now, in this chapter, there's something serene. I want you to note these things as we read the text today. Just fill you with a little background, okay? Before we read the text, there's something serene and detached about Job's speech on wisdom here. In fact, so serene and detached is it. Go ahead, read as I'm speaking and just kind of preview that text. So serene and detached is this psalm to wisdom that many commentators can't accept that Job could deliver this after all of the sturm and drawing of his previous speeches. How could a man in such agony of body and spirit deliver such a composed, mature, reflective dissertation on wisdom? So perplexed are such commentators that they drop this chapter as a late edition. Or else they rearrange it in the mouth of Bildad. who had so little to say anyway. But when you read this chapter, as we have been reading it, that is as a refined reflection on wisdom. After enduring the gauntlet of suffering, Job has, in a trial by ordeal, it makes perfect sense. Job has been subject to being the accused in a patriarchal lawsuit where Satan, whose very name means adversary, is the prosecuting attorney, charging that Job cannot possibly fear God for naught. Do you see how the fear of God is just shot through as a strong cable all through this book? Satan maintains that Job must be obeying and keeping covenant for what he can get in a kind of quid pro quo arrangement. I obey, you bless God. I disobey, and you curse. Satan suggests, curse him out of all proportion to his sin, O great judge of the universe, and you will see Job drop all pretense of fear for you. He will curse God and die, as his wife advised him to do. He will become disillusioned and despair of recovery, and you will see that Job does not really love you for who you are and repose trust in you, that you're doing this for his ultimate good, no matter what things seem like at present. No, Job's suffering will break him, not make him. Yet we have seen just the opposite transpire. Job has held together two mutually exclusive truths at once. First of all, God is just. He has held to this all through his suffering. God is just, punishing the wicked and rewarding the righteous. The law of lux talionis, at the basis of all true judgment in the end. But he has also held equally true, I am righteous, though I'm being punished as if I were wicked. Two mutually exclusive truths on the surface. I am righteous, and I hold to my integrity, though I'm being punished as if I were wicked. These two apparently mutually exclusive truths have driven other wise men, in this case, the three amigos, right? To the obvious conclusion that Job's wickedness must be great since his cursed condition is so great. Can't you see this, Job? Just confess and all will be made right. His clinging to his integrity has only compounded that wickedness in their eyes. That's the theme of all their speeches. Well, so much for conventional wisdom. Job's suffering in embracing these two opposite, incompatible truths has driven him to another level of wisdom altogether. Have you seen that transpire in this book all the way through? He has been driven in his suffering to another level of wisdom altogether, far surpassing leaving in the dust, moving into warp drive, if you will. Through his suffering, he has reached a level of wisdom and revelation unachievable by any other means. Since he is righteous, but is suffering nonetheless, then his suffering must be for a reason other than as being wicked. He's been driven to this since God is just. Though exasperating, the reason and purpose has not been revealed to him. He knows this. Ergo, our principle, there is suffering, the reason and purpose for which is not revealed to the sufferer or those around him. That is a general principle of suffering. And it is perfectly capable of ministering to those who are suffering as well, if we bring it home to their hearts and minds. It's a little abstract the way we put it here, but you have wisdom, you have skill, people skills to minister that principle to those who are in the midst of suffering. And that the wicked thrive and prosper in this age also compels this corollary truth. That is, there is prospering of the wicked. There is prospering of the wicked, the reason and purpose for which is not revealed to the righteous in this age. We've seen this as well. Job is driven to the revelation and knowledge of this wisdom through his suffering. And further, as we have seen clearly documented for us, Job's suffering has compelled him to two other profound truths. Number one, my Redeemer lives. He built up to that, didn't he? He saw tracks of that all the way up to that beautiful chapter 19 of Job. My Redeemer lives. There is an intercessor, a mediator, a redeemer for him who mediates between himself and God. It can be no other way, since Job confesses time and again, I cannot stand before God in my own person. The second profound truth, I shall behold God in my own flesh and not another on the last day. I shall behold God in my own flesh and not another on the last day. Job is driven to the truth, revealed and driven, that there must be a resurrection of the dead, since God is just and I am righteous. I'm unjustly treated as a wicked one while in my flesh, and consequently, I must be vindicated at the day of judgment. God is just. I will be vindicated on the day of judgment in my flesh, since I'm suffering in my flesh, in order for there to be true justice. So, Job's suffering has transported him to a transcendent wisdom, a level of wisdom and revelation the three amigos could never achieve. Job has soundly trounced them in this trial by ordeal. He is God's champion, leaving these guys in the dust of their foolishness. Therefore, it is only to be expected that, having been silenced of the barking, yapping dogs at his heels, Job finds himself in a place of peace and serenity. He is able to reflect upon wisdom unopposed, undeterred by the foolishness of sinful men. He is free to set groundwork for the wisdom literature of Israel. This is indeed in the patriarchal period. He's doing precisely that, if indeed our thesis is correct, that Job was reduced to Hebrew in the period of Solomon, when he gathered wisdom from all over the world and composed his own as well, based on the ancient wisdom. Well, with this in mind, let's read verses 1 through 6 of chapter 28. Surely there's a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth and copper is smelted from the ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out the farthest limit, the ore in gloom and deep darkness. He opens shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten by travelers. They hang in the air far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the places of sapphires, and it has dust of gold. A different tone to this wisdom literature, right? We've heard some of these themes all through the three friends of Job, but there's a ring of truth and a quality here that is transcending the other speeches. Well, how often wisdom is likened to the precious metals of the earth so valued by man. Proverbs 3, I'm sure Solomon, in his wisdom, as he reflects on the wisdom of the patriarchal period, he pens this in Proverbs chapter 3. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding, for the gain from her is better than gain from silver and her profit better than gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand, and her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. Wisdom, she is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. Those who hold her fast are called blessed. Standard feature of wisdom literature, isn't it? That it is such, that is a standard feature, should not diminish its truth any more than the constant reminder and extolling by us of God's marvelous grace and salvation, for example. Do you tire of the theme of grace? I never do. So we should never tire of the theme of the worth, infinite worth of wisdom. Because wisdom is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her. How precious is the wisdom to hold one's tongue in an angry situation when others lash out? How precious is the biblical wisdom to not darken the door of the adulterous woman while others beat a path to it? How precious is the wisdom to work industriously, making the best of one's skills and energies, as Solomon so often exhorts us to do in Ecclesiastes, for example, while others cynically rely on government handouts? Such wisdom gets one far ahead in life with joy and riches and honor. And this is reflected in the consequences for man when his search compels him. That is, he achieves dominion over the earth he would not otherwise get when he lacks a search for that which is precious. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out the farthest limit, the ore and gloom and deep darkness. He opens shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten by travelers. They hang in the air far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. This analogy with mining also communicates to us the relative remoteness of wisdom, too, from the common paths to which man travels. Wisdom is not found in the ways of man, in the religions of man. I'm constantly surprised at this as I travel Idaho. Idaho's a mining state. We should get this, right? The gem state. I remember jogging some remote trails in some of the parks and suddenly stumbling upon several abandoned mine shafts. They're all over Idaho, aren't they? Who knew? How interesting, I thought one day, bright sunny day in Idaho, maybe I should go explore them a bit. Then again, maybe not. Maybe the better part of wisdom is to leave abandoned mine shafts well enough alone. But they're not on the beaten paths, are they, of the world? For example, you won't find the blessed rest of the Sabbath. Have you learned to find the blessed rest of the Sabbath? You won't find that blessed rest of the Sabbath following and being obsessed by the beaten path of sports, for example. This is football season gears up. And I'm tempted to follow. You will not find the blessings of wise governance that Solomon so ably commends in Ecclesiastes. You won't find the blessings of wise governance by following the beaten path of turbulent passions of American politics, modern American politics especially. And this as the midterm elections gear up. You will not find the true value of wealth, the true value of wealth, and there is value in wealth, which, once again, Solomon so ably commends in Ecclesiastes. You won't find it by following the beaten path of chasing the almighty dollar for its own sake. Following the beaten path of the world just gets you beaten, doesn't it? But in those remote places of wisdom, there are things precious, like places of sapphires, dust of gold. Certainly the surface of the earth yields grain for bread, salutary, necessary for life for all men. But his search for precious stones and metals turns and churns up the earth as by fire, right? Just go visit the remnants of the open pit copper mine in Butte, Montana sometime. So has Job gone to those places of wisdom. Off the beaten path of comfort and ease lies the path of suffering that he has traveled. But on that journey, what precious wisdom Job has acquired, has he not? And shared with us, shared with his generation and generations subsequent. Well, he also reflects upon our place of dominion in nature too. Point two, verses 7 through 11. Wisdom refined. I hope you sense the elegant, refined nature of Job's wisdom brought to you by his suffering. Point number two, as Job experienced in his suffering, wisdom is not available to any other creature but man, God's image bearer. Verses 7 through 11, chapter 28. That path no bird of prey knows, and the falcon's eye has not seen it. The proud beasts have not trodden it. The lion has not passed over it. Man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams so that they do not trickle, and the thing that is hidden, he brings out to light. Job here contrasts man, God's image bearer, with two creatures renowned, one for a keen eye for prey, that is the falcon, and another for establishing dominion, that is the lion. Man excels them both in his search for wisdom. These resonate with me. One of the joys of living in Idaho is watching the hawk and the eagle fly over the fields searching for prey. Saw this three times on my way in today. Just hawks scouring the fields, especially mown fields, looking for those little rodents. Given the complete absence of man in nature, and that's a condition to be desired by modern environmentalists, I make no mistake about that. But given the complete absence of man in nature, precious gems and metals would go unretrieved, unnoticed by the flora and fauna of the earth. So it would be with wisdom. Wisdom would be an attribute and property of God alone, bestowed upon the sons of God in measure, perhaps, as we've seen from the prologue. But his alone, wisdom would be his alone intrinsically, as it is. But instead, by virtue of God's creation, wisdom is an attribute which can be found on the earth, resident in the creature who reflects God's image, that is man. Just as man takes masterful dominion over the earth, he overturns mountains. Some of you have been through the Eisenhower Tunnel in Colorado. Mountain overturned to dig that, wasn't there? He cuts channels in the rock. Any modern highway, 80 as it makes its way through Wyoming, for example. He dams up streams. How about the Hoover Dam? Pretty big stream to dam up, isn't it? He takes masterful dominion in these things, and so he takes, or he can take, masterful dominion in finding and using wisdom, too. And once more, this is precisely what Job has done in this trial by ordeal. He has mastered true wisdom, hasn't he? He stands astride his foes. He has held to his integrity while simultaneously holding to the justice of God. Job is neither unrighteous, though he's being treated as such, nor is God unjust, though treating Job as if he were unrighteous. God has a purpose and reason for causing Job to suffer, which he chooses not to reveal to me at present. Though I long for it, Job has longed for it, hasn't he? And what must consequently be true is that there is one to mediate for me and a resurrection of my body in order to reveal all of these things and bring true, just resolution to all of this. What falcon would have perceived this? What lion would have taken such dominion of this wisdom as Job has? And Job has taken dominion of wisdom. This is truly wisdom literature. Wisdom of the cross, however. It was certainly not an attribute of his friends, was it, either? But Job is not through. Verses 12 through 22. And point number three. Wisdom we've refined. We are seeing a refined and beautiful wisdom unfolded for us here in this psalm to wisdom. As Job experienced in his suffering, Wisdom is not found in the places of depth and riches of man. Verses 12 to 22. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. From where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and death say, we have heard a rumor of it with our ears. Now, we're building towards an overwhelming revelation of the supernatural origin of true wisdom. And it will be fully met in the appearance of God on the scene to pronounce judgment. That will be the next major step in our patriarchal lawsuit. But we get here a sense for the supernatural origin of true wisdom by finding out that it's not to be found in nature naturally. First of all, these verses tell us that it is not intrinsic to man, all of this having been lost in the fall. Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living, and it is hidden from the eyes of all living. Wisdom is not intrinsic to man, nor does nature. Wisdom is not intrinsic to nature per se. The created realm does not contain it. Certainly, wisdom is deep, figuratively, but it is not to be found in the deep, in the abyss, the underworld. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. Once again, symbols of chaos and death. It's the sense of it not being with Abaddon, that is destruction and death, which have only heard a rumor of it with our ears. How eloquent that is, isn't it? And nothing that man values and treasures can equal the value of wisdom. Job catalogs those things for us, doesn't he? Gold, silver, gems, and stones. How man loves these things, how he lusts after them. One of the best films ever made, I think, cataloging this, unfolding this for us, is Treasure of the Sierra Madre, 1948, great film. Go and put that in your queue. John Huston, Humphrey Bogart, and the corrosive effect of greed and lust for gold that erodes the character and spirit of man. And where is the wisdom when you read your history? Where's the wisdom in the history of any gold rush? Any gold rush in history, whether it's California gold rush, the Alaska gold rush. Job is saying, if only there were a gold rush for wisdom, how a man would benefit, right? If there was the equal kind of desire for true godly wisdom. And Job is consigning the wisdom of his friends to this realm. Where is true wisdom then? That brings us to point four. Wisdom refined. Once again, as Job experienced in his suffering, no wisdom, the kind of which Job has, is gotten without going through his suffering. As Job experienced in his suffering, wisdom is found by the Lord giver of it unto those who fear him. Wisdom is found out of the beaten path, In those places, no man looks, no bird or no lion would ever stumble upon. But it is found and is given by the Lord giver of it unto those who fear him. That bring it to tears almost? I mean, what is Job? What's been the theme throughout the book of Job? Behold, a man, blameless and upright, who fears God and rejects evil. Verses 23 to 28. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding. What has God been saying about Job all along, huh? And Job declares boldly the utter, complete, and exclusive source of wisdom. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. I think Job knows this. To his gut, to his toenails. Job knows this now, doesn't he? In his suffering. And this is, once again, a warning to us, too. Because despite the ecumenical spirit that is nascent in much of the church today, especially liberal circles, there's a desire to befriend the other world religions. Christianity does itself no favors by relinquishing this point. In the biblical God of Christianity alone do we find true wisdom. In the biblical God of Christianity alone do we find true wisdom. Paul says, Christ in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And this wisdom, too, has been sourced from the beginning of God's creation. And Job unfolds that for us so beautifully, doesn't he? He looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave the wind its weight, now he's hearkening back to the days of creation. Wisdom has been extant to man from day one. But in God alone, in the fear of God. Now this is a theme that is going to roll all through the rest of the book of Job. Job begins that snowball that's going to turn into an avalanche by the time God gets on the scene. And he's going to unfold for chapter after chapter. Where were you, Job? During creation, when I instilled wisdom. Job understands this principle nascently in its seed form. And he unfolds that for us. When he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, such beautiful, eloquent wisdom poetry that's just going to resonate now through these remaining chapters. Once again, all the tedium is behind us now, the tedium of the speeches of Job's three friends, and we are beginning a momentum that will crescendo in the appearance of God in his pronouncing his verdict. That will be the verdict time is when God comes on the scene. But we'll have anticipations of this all through the rest of the book, especially with Elihu. Wait till we get to Elihu as well. So this wisdom has been sourced from the beginning of God's creation. Then he saw it and declared it, right? Verse 27 says, he established it and searched it out. So God understands the way to it because he created it and instilled it. And man finds it. How? How does man find it? By going to university? Only Harvard graduates can achieve biblical wisdom? No. Job brings it all back home, doesn't he? With wisdom's constant refrain. And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding. Job knew that before. Job lived that before. But now he knows it with every fiber of his being, doesn't he? After having endured this in suffering and come to this conclusion again and again and again, and now in a way refined by his suffering. And this will be the constant theme then of those subsequent to Job, will it not? David experiences suffering as well, unjust suffering, continues to trust in God, continues to fear God and turn from evil, such that he is characterized as a man after God's own heart. And then, of course, culminating in the life of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who indeed endured suffering, the reason and purpose for which was not revealed to those around him at the time, right? Only in subsequent days, especially with the letters of Paul, do we have unfolded for us the rich impact of Christ's death and suffering for us, the salvific nature of suffering for us in Christ. And here we have that profoundly seen for us, foreshadowed for us in the life of Job. Job being a type of Christ in a very real sense because of his suffering. And because of his coming to revelation, to understanding and knowledge of a Redeemer. You think Job had any idea that the Redeemer that he foresaw and foreshadowed and typified in his own life would be a suffering Redeemer and Savior? I think he might have. He wouldn't have been surprised if he didn't have it directly revealed. He wouldn't have been surprised. Oh, the Redeemer has to suffer as well because of Job's own sufferings, which indeed foreshadowed. Do you see Christ in the book of Job? Christ is there in the book of Job, is he not? Not in the full way we see him, fuller way that we see him, but he is certainly there in the book of Job, and Job knew him. Well, let us come to that place where we see Christ reprised, his sufferings reprised for us very simply, but very eloquently, the body and blood and bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.